So, imagine finding the absolute best house in a notoriously tough neighborhood.
Right, like a real fortress.
Exactly. The foundation is poured thick, the roof is reinforced, the plumbing is state of the art.
It weathers every storm.
Yeah, it weathers every storm while the houses down the street are literally falling apart or facing foreclosure.
Sure.
But right now, today, it's priced as if that tough neighborhood just magically became a permanent, ultra-exclusive gated community.
Which is a pretty bold assumption.
It really is. And here is the real kicker, the part that should make any prospective buyer pause. The people who built the house, the ones who know the neighborhood better than anyone else alive,
Yeah.
they are quietly packing their bags, locking the doors, and heading for the exits.
Oh, wow.
So the question becomes, what happens to the value of that fortress if someone just opens the gate?
That tension is just the perfect lens for the financial mystery we are dissecting today.
It really sets the stage.
It does, because we are looking at a scenario where a genuinely exceptional corporate franchise is colliding with a stock market that has a nasty habit of mistaking a cyclical peak for a permanent structural reality.
Which happens all the time.
Exactly. Spotting the difference between a durable advantage and a temporary windfall is it's one of the hardest things to do in investing. And the people running this specific company seem to be sending a very clear signal about which one we are currently experiencing.
Right, so welcome to today's deep dive. We are zeroing in on an independent equity research report dated August 5, 2026, and the subject is Tenaris S.A., trading on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker TS.
A massive industrial giant.
Yeah, a $29.3 billion giant to be exact. And our mission today is to tear down the engine of this
You know,
company.
Gabriel makes it tick.
Exactly. We need to understand its genuine competitive advantages, the real bricks in that fortress we talked about, and then figure out why a massive $300 to $600 million chunk of its current annual profits might actually just be a mirage created by political policy.
That's a huge chunk of change to just be a mirage.
It really is. So by the end of this deep dive, you are going to understand how to read the subtle tells of corporate insiders, how to evaluate a complex financial moat, and how to separate operational excellence from temporary geopolitical luck.
So to evaluate if a company is truly worth nearly $30 billion, we have to start by looking at the physical reality of what they actually do.
Right.
And despite pulling in $11.9 billion in revenue in 2025, Tenaris is not a company most people interact with on a daily basis.
No, you're not buying their stuff at the grocery store.
Not at all. They operate in a highly specialized industrial business-to-business space. They are the undisputed largest player in a very specific oligopoly known as the premium seamless OCTG market.
Okay, let's unpack those acronyms for everyone really quick. OCTG stands for Oil Country Tubular Goods.
Right.
Essentially, we are talking about the steel tubes and pipes that the global energy industry uses to extract oil and natural gas from the ground. And this isn't just, a side hustle for them.
No, it's their bread and butter.
Yeah, tubes make up a staggering 95% of their total revenue. They are a laser-focused, pure-play pipe manufacturer.
And their position in that market is incredibly dominant. Alongside Vallourec, Nippon Steel, and JFE, Tenaris and its peers control roughly 45% of the global market for these specific goods.
That's massive share.
It is. But the research we're looking at draws a very sharp, crucial line between two entirely different sides of the OCTG market. It is dangerous to look at this industry and just think, steel pipes.
Because all pipes are not created equal.
Exactly. The market is physically and economically split in two.
Right. So on one side, you have the commodity layer. These are welded pipes, often referred to as API grades.
Yeah, and the manufacturing process for the commodity side is relatively straightforward. You basically take a flat sheet of steel, roll it into a cylinder, and weld it shut down the seam.
Pretty basic industrial stuff.
Totally. Because the process is standardized and easily replicable, the barriers to entry are incredibly low. If you have the capital to build a basic rolling and welding mill, you are in the game.
Which means lots of competition.
Exactly. Consequently, this side of the market is highly fragmented, aggressively competitive, and frankly, completely flooded by Chinese manufacturing capacity.
Like TPCO.
Right, companies like TPCO in China have massive capacity churning out millions of tons a year. In that environment, you are a pure price taker. You sell your pipe based on who is offering the cheapest price per ton on that given day.
A race to the bottom. But Tenaris doesn't derive its massive valuation from selling basic rolled steel.
No, they don't.
The real engine of their business is the premium side. We're talking about premium seamless pipes. Let's break down the physical difference, because a seamless pipe isn't rolled and welded.
Right. It's an entirely different metallurgical feat. To make a seamless pipe, you take a solid, glowing hot cylinder of solid steel billet and you essentially pierce it through the center while stretching it out.
That sounds intense.
It is. There is no seam, no weld line, and therefore no obvious structural weak point. And that structural integrity is absolutely non-negotiable for the environments where these pipes are deployed.
Because they're going into some extreme places.
Extremely extreme. We are talking about deep water offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico or off the coast of Brazil. We are talking about high pressure, high temperature environments or HPHT wells where the pressure can exceed 20,000 pounds per square inch and temperatures can melt standard equipment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we're also talking about the complex multi-mile lateral drilling used in modern U.S. shale extraction where the pipe is bent and torqued horizontally deep underground.
The forces acting on that steel must be almost incomprehensible, which I guess explains why the barriers to entering this premium market are so astronomically high.
They are massive.
Our source material notes that to even compete at this level, a competitor needs to build a state-of-the-art greenfield mill. And a greenfield mill doesn't mean retrofitting some abandoned auto plant, right?
Not at all.
It means buying a literal empty greenfield and constructing a $1.8 billion technologically advanced manufacturing facility from the dirt up, exactly like Tenaris did with their Bay City plant in Texas.
And, you know, finding $1.8 billion in capital is actually the easiest barrier to overcome.
Wait, really? The money is the easy part.
Believe it or not, yes. The true impenetrable wall protecting Tenaris's market share is time and trust. Once you build that billion-dollar mill, you can't just start selling to ExxonMobil or Saudi Aramco the next day. There is a brutal five-plus-year qualification lag.
Right. The API, or P5C5, CLL4 testing protocols, that is a mouthful. But the concept is just fascinating.
It really is. It's the most rigorous testing protocol in the industry. An operator will subject your pipe, and specifically the threaded connections at the end of your pipe, to extreme simulated environments.
So they really torture test.
Oh, yeah. They bake it, they freeze it, they compress it, they try to tear the threading apart under immense torque. They are looking for microscopic failures.
And even if you pass that?
Even if you pass in the lab, they will then require field testing in non-critical wells for years before they ever trust you on a flagship project.
Wow. So it's a huge time sink.
Exactly. Because of this five-year purgatory, nobody in the Western world is financing new seamless capacity right now. The moat is simply too deep, and the timeline to profitability is too long for modern private equity or public markets to stomach.
That makes total sense. Which brings us to the second layer of their business model, which is the proprietary connections. The report mentions the Tenaris Hydrol family brands like Wedge, Blue, and Dopeless connections.
Right.
So think about this like the world's most expensive, highly engineered plumbing. If a pipe bursts in my house because the threading on a joint gives out, it's a massive headache. It ruins the drywall, maybe destroys some hardwood floors, and I'm out a few $1,000s.
Which is bad enough.
Right. But if the connection between two steel pipes fails 3 miles below the ocean floor in a deep water drill,
the consequences are apocalyptic.
Exactly. You lose the well, which costs hundreds of millions of dollars. You potentially lose the drilling rig. You face catastrophic environmental fines that can run into the billions.
Yeah, it's a nightmare scenario.
So an energy major is not going to penny pinch on the connection. They aren't going to risk a multi-billion dollar asset just to save 3% on a Chinese knockoff pipe joint that hasn't survived that five-year qualification gauntlet.
You nailed it. The psychology of the buyer in this premium segment is driven entirely by risk mitigation, not cost savings.
It's all about safety and reliability.
Exactly. The cost of failure is so asymmetrical to the cost of the pipe that operators develop deeply entrenched multi-year, multi-decade relationships with trusted suppliers. The search cost and the switching cost to find, verify, and monitor a new supplier simply isn't worth the marginal savings on the steel itself.
That makes total sense.
And Tenaris has spent decades iterating their threading technology against the actual changing demands of the field. When shale drillers needed to push laterals out to 3 miles, Tenaris engineered the connections to handle that specific torque.
Right, they adapt to the need.
Yeah. When operators needed ultra-high strength grades for 20K deepwater wells, Tenaris formulated the metallurgy.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most critical layer of their business, the service side. They call it Rig Direct. This isn't just, you know, dropping off a pile of pipes at a port in Houston and wishing the driller good luck.
Not at all. Rig Direct is an integrated white glove supply chain service. Tenaris actually takes over the inventory management for national oil companies, known as NOCs, and international oil companies, the IOCs.
So they handle everything.
They deliver the pipe directly from the manufacturing mill to the specific drilling rig exactly when it is needed.
And the scale of these contracts is just staggering. Our source material outlines an almost $2 billion agreement with ADNOC in the United Arab Emirates, where Tenaris manages half of their entire OCTG needs.
Well, that's a massive contract.
Huge. And they have similar integrated agreements with Saudi Aramco, Qatar Energy, Ecopetrol in Colombia, Petrobras in Brazil, and massive players in the U.S. shale patch. They are embedding themselves into the digital and physical supply chains of the biggest energy producers on the planet.
And that integration, it establishes the foundation of Tenaris's business quality. They aren't merely selling a piece of forged steel. They are selling catastrophic failure prevention, backed by massive logistical convenience.
So full package.
Exactly. But as any financial analyst knows, being a fundamentally good business with an integrated service model does not automatically grant you infinite pricing power.
And that distinction is vital.
Yeah.
We really need to pressure test this legendary moat. We need to understand exactly what Rig Direct actually does for Tenaris, especially when the oil industry inevitably crashes.
Because it always does.
Right, because the energy sector is violently cyclical.
Yeah.
It booms to the heavens and it busts down to the bedrock.
Yeah, the true test of a competitive advantage is never how much money you print when oil is sitting at $120 a barrel and every rig in the world is turning to the right.
A rising tide lifts all boats right.
Even the leaky ones. The real stress test of a corporate moat is the financial signature of the company when the bottom falls out of the market entirely.
And the historical data provided in the report on this exact dynamic is really striking. If we look back at the brutal industry troughs, specifically the oil crash of 2015 to 2016 and the COVID-induced demand destruction of 2020, Tenaris survived while its competitors bled out.
They really did.
During those deep down cycles, Tenaris maintained positive EBITDA margins earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization of 12 to 18%.
Maintaining double-digit positive EBITDA in a severe industrial down cycle is just phenomenal. To put that into stark perspective, look at their closest pure-play peer in the premium space, Vallourec.
How did they do?
During that same 2015 to 2020 period, Vallourec ran negative EBITDA for years. They were literally burning cash just to keep the lights on, and they were forced to undergo two separate massive corporate restructurings.
Oh, wow. So they were really hurting.
Severely. The premium end of the OCTG market witnessed massive competitor exits, capacity closures, and bankruptcies over the last decade. Meanwhile, Tenaris just kept grinding forward, remaining structurally profitable.
So our source material applies the Greenwald taxonomy of competitive advantage to figure out exactly why Tenaris survives these crashes. And the conclusion is pretty nuanced. They say Tenaris has a narrow but highly durable moat.
Right. So Bruce Greenwald's framework is incredibly useful for dissecting industrial companies. Greenwald posits that genuine competitive advantages typically stem from one of two places: demand-side customer captivity or supply-side local economies of scale.
Okay, so which one is Tenaris?
Well, Tenaris does not possess a global cost advantage. If they could simply make steel cheaper than anyone else on Earth, Chinese producers wouldn't be a threat in the commodity space.
That makes sense.
But what they do possess is fierce customer captivity driven by that Rig Direct service, combined with local economies of scale within specific protected geographical basins.
Let's isolate the true value of Rig Direct during a crash then. Because if an exploration and production company decided to drop Tenaris during a downturn to save a few bucks on cheaper pipe, they wouldn't just be swapping steel.
Right, it's way more complicated than that.
They would have to rehire internal supply chain teams, put massive amounts of pipe inventory back onto their own balance sheet, tying up crucial working capital when cash is tightest, and they would have to requalify new technical services. The friction to leave is massive.
Huge friction.
Our sources explicitly state that Rig Direct buys share retention during downturns. The volume stays sticky because the customer is locked into the service ecosystem.
Exactly. Consider the mechanics of an oil bust. A major driller might cut their active rig count from 100 rigs down to just 20. But because of Rig Direct, those remaining 20 rigs are still exclusively using Tenaris pipe.
So they keep that baseline revenue.
Yes. That baseload of sticky volume is what allows them to cover their fixed costs and stay profitable at the bottom of the cycle. However, there is a critical distinction we must make here. one that the research emphasizes heavily.
What's that?
Retaining volume does not equate to pricing power.
Okay, this is the exact moment in the research where I had to stop and reread a paragraph.
Yeah.
Because it completely inverted my assumption.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive.
If Rig Direct is so utterly essential, if it's the Amazon Prime logistics network of the oil field, shouldn't Tenaris be able to dictate terms? Shouldn't they be able to name their price?
You would think so.
But the data proves the opposite. When the U.S. government imposed massive 50% tariffs on imported steel, U.S. domestic prices for OCTG stayed flat for almost three straight quarters. If Tenaris had ultimate pricing power, wouldn't they have passed that massive tariff cost onto their customers on day one?
Exactly, they would have.
The fact that they absorbed it for 9 months essentially proves they are price takers, not price makers.
That delay is the definitive tell regarding the limitations of their moat. A true franchise, a consumer monopoly with an impenetrable wide moat, dictates price to the market regardless of external conditions.
Like a luxury brand.
Right, think of a luxury goods maker or a dominant software platform. Tenaris cannot do that. The macroeconomic cycle dictates the price of steel pipe, and Tenaris has to accept it.
So the moat is defensive.
Their competitive advantage is fundamentally defensive. It acts as a shield, protecting their volume and margins at the absolute bottom of the cycle, ensuring survival while weaker peers face bankruptcy. But it is not a sword.
It doesn't let them attack on price.
No, it does not allow them to artificially inflate their prices at the top of the cycle. When management admits that prices only started to respond three quarters after a major structural cost increase, they are admitting to a lack of pricing power.
But if they lack structural offensive pricing power, how do we explain the numbers they are currently posting?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because our research notes that their recent EBITDA margins exploded to over 24%. That is incredibly high compared to their historical mid-cycle average of around 19 to 20%. If it is an operational leverage or pricing dominance driving that extra 4 to 5% of pure profit, what is the phantom engine pumping up these numbers?
To solve that mystery, we have to look outside the company entirely. We have to separate genuine operational excellence from a temporary, highly lucrative geopolitical policy umbrella.
Mm.
To understand why Tenaris is currently valued at nearly $30 billion, you must understand the mechanics of Section 232.
The tariff wall. The timeline here is crucial. In March of 2025, Section 232 steel tariffs were reimposed by the United States government at a rate of 25%. Every prior country exemption that existed was abruptly terminated.
A huge shock to the system.
Definitely. Then, just 3 months later, in June 2025, that tariff was aggressively doubled to a punishing 50%. And the government didn't stop there by April 2026. They closed existing loopholes and extended that massive 50% tax to derivative steel products as well.
Now, view this strictly through the lens of a foreign steel producer trying to sell into the American market.
It's got to be devastating.
It is a catastrophic, often terminal, economic barrier. You simply cannot absorb a 50% margin hit and remain competitive. The macroeconomic data reflected this instantly.
What happened?
The overall U.S. finished steel import share plummeted from 22% down to roughly 15% as foreign capacity was effectively choked out of the market. But for Tenaris, this protectionist policy was a massive, immediate financial windfall.
Because they aren't shipping all their steel across the ocean, they actually melt and manufacture the steel right inside the United States.
Precisely. Tenaris supplies roughly 90% of its total U.S. sales directly from its own domestic manufacturing footprint.
Right, from that Texas plant.
Yeah, remember that $1.8 billion Bay City Greenfield plant? Combine that with the massive ex-IPSCO assets they acquired in Coppell and Ambridge, Pennsylvania. Because they have established this sprawling domestic infrastructure, they get to sit safely behind that 50% tariff wall.
So they don't pay the tax.
They are melting scrap and producing steel domestically, which means they do not pay the 50% import tax on the vast majority of what they sell to American drillers. However, because foreign competitors are locked out, the overall domestic price of steel pipe rises significantly.
Win-win for them.
Big time. Tenaris gets to sell their product at the new, artificially high tariff-protected price without paying the associated tariff costs.
It's a brilliant geopolitical arbitrage. Our sources give this dynamic a specific name. They call it policy rent, and they quantify it. They estimate that between $300 and $600 million of Tenaris's annual EBITDA, which translates to 2 to 4 full percentage points on their margin, is pure tariff rent.
$500 million of profit generated entirely by a political signature.
It's wild to think about.
It is, but it is crucial for anyone listening to view it impartially, purely as a mechanical financial mechanism. We're not endorsing the politics either way here.
Right, we're just looking at the math.
Exactly. The 50% wall chokes supply, which creates a pricing umbrella, which inflates domestic profits. But the inherent danger of policy rent is that it is fundamentally fragile. Because it was created by a political signature, it can be erased by a political signature.
It can vanish overnight.
It is not a structural reality of the free market. It is an artificial subsidy.
Think of it like this. Imagine you operate a highly successful lemonade stand in a busy park. You do great business because you have a great recipe.
Sure.
But one day, the local mayor decrees that no one else is allowed to sell lemonade within a 5-mile radius. Or if they do, they have to pay a massive 50% tax on their lemons. Almost overnight, your competition vanishes. You can raise your prices, your profits skyrocket, and you are pulling in record cash.
Sounds like a great deal for you.
It does. But you would be incredibly foolish to go out, buy a mansion, and take on a 30-year mortgage, assuming that the mayor's ban is a permanent law of physics. You are simply renting that excess profit from the mayor's office. The moment a new mayor is elected or the town council changes the rules, your margins violently snap back to reality.
That analogy perfectly illustrates the precarious nature of the stock's current valuation. The broader market is currently pricing Tenaris as if the mayor's lemonade ban is going to last forever.
You think it's permanent?
Right. They are capitalizing that extra $300 to $600 million in policy rent into perpetuity. So the analytical exercise becomes, what happens to the stock if that assumption breaks? What happens if the 50% wall is dropped or replaced with a much weaker, porous quota system?
Our sources describe that scenario as double jeopardy. And it's terrifying for a shareholder because the damage compounds. It's not just that your raw earnings drop, the underlying multiple that the market applies to those earnings collapses at the same time.
It is a brutal mathematical reality. If the tariff is reversed, you instantly lose that $500 million in EBITDA rent. Your bottom line shrinks.
And then market panics.
But simultaneously, institutional investors realize that Tenaris is highly vulnerable to political whims. The aura of invincibility shatters. Suddenly, the premium valuation multiple they were enjoying evaporates. The stock re-rates from a high-quality industrial multiple down closer to a volatile commodity steel multiple.
Ouch.
Yeah. The research clearly states that in a tariff reversal scenario alone, and this is without even factoring in a broader economic recession or a drop in oil prices, the stock plummets to a valuation of $29 to $36 in ADS.
$29 to $36. And remember, just prior to this August report, the stock was trading comfortably up around $58. We are talking about a potential 40 to 50% haircut hiding in plain sight, entirely dependent on a single trade policy remaining untouched.
That policy rent is the single most fragile, load-bearing assumption holding up the stock price. But the risk doesn't stop at the U.S. border.
Because they're a global company.
Tenaris is a truly global enterprise, deeply entrenched in international geopolitics. And while American politics are artificially inflating their numbers in the West, they are simultaneously navigating a massive physical and geopolitical crisis in the East.
Which brings us to the global choke point. We have to analyze the impact of the U.S.-Israel-Iran war and the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz.
The macroeconomic landscape in 2026 is a minefield. In late February of 2026, the U.S.-Israel-Iran conflict broke out. The immediate cascading consequence for global trade was the severe restriction and intermittent outright closure of the Strait of Hormuz.
For context for everyone, the Strait of Hormuz is essentially the jugular vein of the global energy market. Our sources point out that roughly 20% of the world's entire oil transit flows through that specific narrow waterway.
It's an incredibly critical passage.
Yeah, when you pinch that vein, the global system goes into shock immediately.
The pricing reaction was violent and immediate. Brent crude oil spiked to around $120 a barrel in April as the market panicked over supply shortages.
Just a massive spike.
Eventually, prices settled back down into the $84 to $87 range after a fragile ceasefire memorandum was signed in June. But while the oil market digested the shock, the operational effect on the OCTG industry and specifically on Tenaris' logistics was completely asymmetric.
So let's break down that asymmetry. How does a company that sells equipment to oil drillers suffer when the price of oil spikes to $120?
It comes down to geography and physics. When oil hits $120, exploration and production companies outside the conflict zone go into a frenzy. Rigs in the U.S. shale basins, deep water platforms in Guyana and offshore Brazil, they all drastically accelerate their drilling programs to capture those astronomical prices.
So demand goes through the roof.
So global demand for Tenaris's premium pipes surges. But simultaneously, Tenaris's massive contracts with the Middle Eastern national oil companies become logistically paralyzed. They physically cannot get the heavy steel product through the Strait of Hormuz safely.
Because you can't exactly load thousands of tons of steel pipe onto a cargo plane. It has to go by sea. And when the waterway is an active conflict zone, the logistics simply break down.
Exactly. Ships just start moving.
Commercial freight lines refuse to transit. Or the insurance premiums from Lloyd's of London skyrocket to levels that wipe out the profit margins of the shipment entirely. You end up with hundreds of millions of dollars of highly engineered steel sitting in ports or idling on ships, completely trapped.
We saw the direct financial damage from this in their forward guidance. Tenaris explicitly guided that their Q2 2026 sales would drop, directly citing these trapped Middle East shipments.
They admitted it was a problem.
They faced spiraling logistics costs and what accountants call unabsorbed fixed costs, meaning the factory is still running and paying workers, but the product isn't being delivered and paid for, so the overhead eats directly into the profit margin.
Just bleeding cash.
Now, the demand isn't permanently destroyed, Saudi Aramco, and ADNRC will still need those pipes eventually to maintain their production capacity. But the revenue is deferred indefinitely, creating a massive sinkhole in their immediate financials.
But the tension in the research report comes from what the management team told Wall Street Next. Tenaris guided for a robust, strong recovery in the second half of 2026. They told investors the earnings would bounce right back.
Which is optimistic, to say the least.
Right. However, the report explicitly flags that this recovery projection is entirely contingent on a singular assumption, the Strait of Hormuz reopening in the short term. They are betting the entire second half of their fiscal year on a fragile geopolitical truce holding perfectly.
It is a massive gamble to bake into corporate guidance. The market is currently modeling out the rest of the year, assuming that the June ceasefire holds unconditionally, that the strait opens, that maritime insurance rates normalize, the trap shipments are smoothly delivered, and Middle East drilling resumes its long-term growth trajectory.
But the reality on the ground is terrifyingly volatile. The research highlights unverified yet highly persistent reports from July 2026 detailing renewed tanker strikes and secondary closures of the strait. The June ceasefire might already be a ghost.
That's a huge problem for their guidance.
Let's ground this in time for you listening. The date of this independent equity research report is August 5th, 2026. Tenaris is scheduled to report their Q2 earnings and update their guidance tomorrow, August 6th. The current $58 stock price requires that unverified ceasefire to hold.
Investors are walking an absolute tightrope over a geopolitical canyon.
If tomorrow's earnings call reveals that the July tanker strikes have indefinitely paralyzed their logistics network, that second half guidance is going to be taken to the woodshed.
We have a macro environment perfectly balanced on two incredibly unstable pillars. Pillar one, U.S. trade policy holding firm with 50% tariffs to generate policy rent. Pillar two, a Middle Eastern ceasefire holding together perfectly to allow volume to flow.
That's a lot of things that need to go right.
That requires a historic level of external geopolitical luck to maintain these record 24% profit margins. Which logically forces us to ask if you were a company insider, an executive who sees the raw daily operational data, who understands the fragility of the political tariffs and then reality of the maritime logistics. How would you behave?
You would follow the money. You would stop listening to the press releases and you would watch exactly what the people with the absolute best mid-cycle math are doing with their personal capital. And the data the research uncovered on insider behavior is blindingly bright.
It is the ultimate leading indicator. We have to look at the actions of Techint.
Who is Techint?
Techint is the holding company controlled by the Rocca and Agostinelli families, and they are the undisputed controllers of Tenaris, historically holding roughly 64 to 68% of the voting shares.
So they run the show.
Completely.
Yeah.
And between December 2025 and February 2026, Techint aggressively sold 23.6 million shares into the open market.
23.6 million shares. Mm-hmm. And the report makes a point to emphasize that this was their first major share sale in five entire years.
half a decade.
They haven't touched their massive stake in half a decade, holding through the COVID crash and the subsequent recovery. And suddenly, right at this specific peak of margins and geopolitical tension, they start unloading.
Naturally, the official corporate disclosure frames the sale in the most benign terms possible, calling it stake management.
Of course they do.
Over the past several years, Tenaris has utilized its massive free cash flow to run aggressive share buyback programs, and they cancel the shares they buy. When a company shrinks its total share count, any shareholder who doesn't sell sees their percentage of ownership passively float upward.
Just basic math.
Because of these buybacks, Tichent's voting rights had drifted up past 70%. The company has a stated policy of keeping the controller's floor at 67%, so the official, legally sanitized narrative is that the family was simply trimming their position to maintain their preferred ownership ratio.
But you cannot look at the timing of that sale in a vacuum. Because while the controlling family was dumping 23.6 million shares into the market, what was the company itself doing?
Buy.
The company was in the middle of executing a massive $1.2 billion share buyback program. So you have a dynamic where the corporate entity is using shareholder cash to aggressively buy stock at market highs, and the controlling family is simultaneously selling their personal shares into that exact same market liquidity.
It is a dynamic that should make any independent investor fiercely scrutinize the valuation. While technically legal and fully disclosed via 13D SEC amendments, the practical reality is that the corporate buyback effectively provided a massive wall of artificial liquidity for the controlling family to cash out near the absolute highs of the stock's five-year run.
It looks really bad.
And this behavior becomes even more alarming when you contrast it against Tenaris's historical record of capital allocation. Because historically, the Rocca family and the Tenaris management team are brilliant allocators of capital. They are famously ruthlessly disciplined.
Our sources highlight a classic example of their discipline. In 2020, at the absolute dark bottom of the pandemic oil crash, they bought IPSGO from a distressed Russian seller for about $1 billion. They bought a massive asset for pennies on the dollar when everyone else in the industry was terrified.
They are apex predators at the bottom of the cycle, and their historical share buyback program was executed with that same brilliance. Prior to this recent run-up, they aggressively retired 14.5% of the company's total outstanding shares at an average price of around $36.
That's amazing.
Buying back a seventh of your company at a multi-year low is incredible, tangible value creation for long-term shareholders. It proves they know exactly how to spot a bargain. They know what the company is intrinsically worth.
But then, in March 2026, right after the controller finishes selling their 23 million shares, the corporate machinery suddenly grinds to a halt. The company terminated the second tranche of its massive $1.2 billion third buyback program early. They just stopped buying.
The official disclosed reason for halting the buyback was highly technical. It was stopped to avoid triggering a derivative make-whole payment to a counterparty bank amid extreme market volatility.
Let's demystify that jargon.
Sure. When a massive corporation executes a billion-dollar buyback, they don't just log into an E-Trade account and click buy. They enter into complex derivative contracts with major investment banks to execute the purchases over time. These contracts have volatility triggers.
So if the market gets too crazy,
if the stock price swings too wildly, the mechanics of the contract break down and the company has to pay a penalty or a make-whole payment to the bank.
So the extreme volatility in the spring of 2026, likely driven by the breakout of the Middle East war, triggered these contractual safeguards. That is the factual, legally sound reason they had to pause that specific tranche. But our research argues that it's the behavior that followed the pause that reveals their true hand.
Exactly. A mechanical pause due to derivative volatility is understandable. But after the dust settled, their buyback activity didn't resume. It essentially flatlined. In the first quarter of 2026, total buybacks plummeted to a meager $90 million, down drastically from $537 million the quarter before.
They just turned it off.
They effectively turned off the tap. And crucially, as of this August 5th report, the company has conspicuously failed to announce a fourth buyback program.
Let's connect those dots. The exact same management team who aggressively bought 14.5% of their own company when the stock was at $36 is now suddenly refusing to buy their own stock when it's hovering around $58.
Yeah.
And while they refused to buy at $58, the controlling family was actively selling at $58.
Add one more massive variable to that timeline. In May 2026, Right in the midst of the buyback halt, the insider selling, and the Middle East logistics crisis, Gabriel Podskubka was elevated to CEO,
making him the very first non-Rocca CEO in the entire history of the company.
Pella Rocca remains deeply involved as the chairman, and Podskubka was previously the COO, so this is a deliberate continuity succession, not a hostile corporate coup. But the timing is impossible to ignore.
It's all happening at once.
A historic shift in leadership lands in the exact same quarter as the controller's massive stock sale, the sudden termination of the corporate buyback program, the peak of U.S. tariff protection, and the physical closure of their primary Middle Eastern transit route.
Let me use an analogy here, because when you stack the timeline up like that, the picture is blindingly obvious. Imagine you and a group of friends are eating at an incredibly lavish, expensive seafood buffet.
Okay, I'm with you.
And the executive chef of the restaurant, who usually sits down in the dining room and eats dinner with you every single night, suddenly stops eating mid-bite. He quietly packs up a large to-go box of food, hands the keys to his sous chef, and walks out the back door into the alley.
Wow.
In that moment, regardless of how good the food tastes, you should probably stop eating the shrimp. The people with the absolute best mid-cycle math, the ones who see the raw, unfiltered data on how dependent those 24% margins are on 50% tariffs and frozen logistics, they are hitting the pause button.
Right.
They aren't buying the shrimp at $58 a plate.
That is the exact analytical pivot an investor needs to make. When the insiders quietly step back from the buffet table, you have to strip away the corporate narrative and look strictly, coldly, at the mathematical valuation. What exactly is the broader market paying for at this current price?
Let's run the valuation reality check. At a share price of $57.96, the total enterprise value of Kinaurus is sitting at roughly $25.5 billion.
To justify a $25.5 billion valuation in the heavy industrial sector, you have to look at the multiple the market is applying to their earnings. Assuming a standard historical through-cycle multiple for a high-quality cyclical company of around 8x EBITDA, the market is essentially capitalizing roughly $3.2 billion of forward annual EBITDA.
Meaning the market is demanding $3.2 billion in profit every single year to justify this price. Which means the market is treating their recent historically high 24 to 25% profit margins, not as a cyclical peak, but as a permanent baseline.
The math requires permanence. The market is looking at the geopolitical supercycle of 2022 and 2023, combining it with the massive 50% tariff bump of 2025, and assuming that heavily subsidized level of profitability is the new normal forever.
But history says otherwise.
But if you look at Tenaris' actual historical record over the last two decades, their mid-cycle margins, the true average profitability smoothed out over full boom and bust cycles, are roughly 19 to 20%.
And if their margins revert to their historical mean of 19 to 20%, that would only yield about $2.4 billion of EBITDA, not the $3.2 billion the market is currently pricing in. That is an $800 million gap in expectations.
The factor modeling detailed in the report really exposes the mechanical disconnect driving the stock. Statistically, in the algorithms that drive modern trading, Tenaris trades primarily as an oil price proxy. The quantitative models show it has a high correlation loading of plus 0.94 to the price of oil.
Let's explain why that correlation exists mechanically. When the price of oil goes up, drillers make significantly more profit per barrel. Flush with cash, they deploy more rigs to drill more holes in the ground to capture that margin.
That makes perfect sense.
More holes in the ground require millions of feet of new steel pipe. So Tenaris' revenue is fundamentally tethered to the price of crude.
But here is the massive disconnect the underlying oil leg has stalled. The International Energy Agency's base case projections for late 2026 are modeling oil at a much cooler $75 to $80 a barrel, forecasting a supply surplus reemerging if the geopolitical tensions in the Middle East ease.
So the oil isn't flying high anymore.
The fundamental engine driving the drillers has downshifted, yet Tenaris' stock price is still accelerating as if oil were screaming past $100.
The underlying engine has stalled out, but the car is somehow still speeding up. Our sources note that the stock is currently sitting at the 95.6 percentile of its own historical price-to-book valuation.
Which is astronomical.
The market is inexplicably assigning Tenaris an oilfield services, or OFS, multiple. An OFS multiple is typically reserved for asset-light, high-tech, proprietary software and service companies like Halliburton or Schlumberger.
Not heavy steel manufacturers.
The market is applying a premium tech service multiple to a heavy industrial steel manufacturer and applying it to earnings that are massively inflated by a reversible political tariff.
The research identifies this as a broader regime signal in the market. It's not just Tenaris. Almost every tariff-protected steel name and every momentum-driven oil service name is sitting at historical euphoric valuation peaks in mid-2026.
Everyone is caught up in the hype.
The market is in a state of exuberance regarding the entire protected sector. But to truly understand the risk, we have to break down what that exuberance means for the actual stock price across three specific modeled scenarios: the bear case, the base case, and the bull case.
Let's start by looking into the abyss. The bear case. The report pegs the bear case valuation at a dismal $34 to $44 a share. What combination of events has to happen for the stock to crater from $58 down to $34?
What's truly alarming is that the bear case does not require a catastrophic global macroeconomic recession. It simply requires the current artificial supports to fall away and revert to normal.
Just a return to normal.
Just a return to normal. If the 50% U.S. tariffs are reversed, struck down by a court, or severely diluted by a new administration, you immediately wipe out that $300 to $600 million in policy rent.
Boom, that's gone.
Add in a scenario where the Strait of Hormuz stays messy, keeping Middle East volume trapped, combined with a standard cyclical cooling in U.S. shale drilling as oil hovers around $75. In that very realistic scenario, top-line revenue drops back to $10 or $11 billion, and the valuation multiple compresses back down to a standard commodity steel level of 7 or 8 times. Run that math, and you arrive squarely in the mid-30s.
Just a politician signing a piece of paper rolling back tariffs gets you 2/3 of the way to that bear case. The downside risk is massive. Okay, what about the base case? What does the math look like if things just stay relatively normal?
The analyst models the base case at $50 to $62 a share, placing the midpoint right around $56. This scenario assumes that the current status quo holds perfectly. It assumes their historical mid-cycle margins hold up against inflation. It assumes the Strait of Hormuz reopens durably without further military escalation. And it assumes the 50% tariffs remain broadly intact to protect their U.S. market share.
Wait, hold on. The base case midpoint is $56. The stock, prior to this report dropping, was already trading at nearly $58.
Yep.
That means the current market price is already sitting completely inside the base case, leaning toward the high end. The market is already fully paid for a near-perfect continuation of the status quo. There is virtually zero margin of safety left for the investor at $58.
You've identified the core asymmetry of the trade. To generate any meaningful market-beating upside from a $58 entry point, you are forced to underwrite the absolute bull case, and the research models that bull case at $70 to $84 a share.
I want to hear the required mechanics for the bull case. What absolute miracle of global economics needs to occur to drive this heavy steel manufacturer up to $84 a share?
To justify $84, you need a flawless convergence of geopolitical and economic tailwinds. You need a massive, historically deferred offshore supercycle to finally materialize in 2027 and 2028, with tens of billions of dollars aggressively flowing into deepwater projects in Brazil, Guyana, and the Gulf of Mexico.
It's a massive boom.
You need the 50% tariff wall to become a permanent, untouchable fixture of American trade policy. You need those historically anomalous 24% margins to somehow defy gravity and become the permanent new floor, surviving a full economic cycle without compressing.
Which goes against their own history.
And perhaps most importantly, you need the newly appointed management team to abruptly reverse course and announce a massive fourth buyback program to continually compound the earnings per share.
So to get the bull case upside, the investor needs a flawless global geopolitical environment, indefinite political protection in Washington, D.C., unprecedented operational margin survival that blatantly defies the company's own historical record, and for the insiders to start buying again after aggressively selling.
It's a tall order.
That is not a margin of safety. That is a blind leap of faith. Why is the broader market, which is generally run by highly intelligent institutional investors, making this specific mistake?
The market isn't making a simple, naive error. It's not just looking at the absolute peak earnings of 2023 and assuming that exact number will print every single year. The market is making a much more subtle, dangerous error, a permanence error.
Permanence error.
Investors are taking a complex blend of cyclical luck, like the temporary oil price spike, mixing it with the artificial policy rent generated by the 50% tariffs, and combining that with some genuine structural operational improvements, like the success of the Rig Direct service.
Okay.
They blend all three of those factors together into a 24% profit margin, and they assume that specific cocktail will be served at the bar forever. They are fundamentally forgetting that two of those three core ingredients, global oil prices and domestic trade tariffs, are entirely external and completely out of the company's control.
It is the equivalent of a professional poker player going on a massive lucky winning streak at the casino for a month, and then going to the bank to apply for a mortgage, claiming that his winning streak is his fixed, guaranteed annual salary.
The analogy is perfect. The underlying skills of the poker player are real, just as Tenaris' operational improvements are very real. Their balance sheet is an absolute fortress, sitting on roughly $3.8 billion in net cash. The management team is intelligent, ruthless, and historically brilliant at capital allocation. Tenaris is a phenomenal company.
Nobody's denying that.
But at $58 a share, you are paying full price for all of that operational excellence. Plus, you are paying a massive premium for a political and geopolitical permanence that simply does not exist in the real world.
So let's step back and survey the landscape of this deep dive. We started by looking at Tenaris as a genuinely phenomenal, cash-rich, exceptionally well-run cyclical industrial company. They have a narrow but incredibly durable competitive moat built on the sticky logistics of their rig direct service, which protects their volume at the bottom of the cycle.
Right, a great foundation.
They have a fortress balance sheet that allows them to play offense and buy distressed assets when everyone else in the industry is panicking and going bankrupt.
Yeah.
But the current reality is that a 50% tariff wall in the United States and a frozen, volatile choke point in the Middle East have combined to create a precarious, artificially inflated peak in their profit margins.
That's the reality.
The market is treating that peak as a plateau. But the ultimate tell, the signal cutting through all the noise, is that the insiders, the people who know this math intimately, who built the fortress, are already quietly stepping away from the buffet table. They halted their buybacks, and the controlling family sold tens of millions of shares.
They see the writing on the wall.
Whether you are prepping for a boardroom pitch, analyzing the risk in your own portfolio, or just trying to understand how global trade actually functions behind the sanitized press releases, Tenaris serves as the ultimate masterclass. It teaches us how to separate a company's true operational moat from a temporary policy umbrella. The enduring lesson here is to relentlessly look for the policy rent.
Always look for the rent.
Whenever you see record margins, you have to do the grueling work of figuring out exactly how much of that profit is dictated by genuine market dominance and how much is merely dictated by a politician temporarily banning the competition.
That ability to dissect the source of a margin is the vital takeaway for any critical thinker looking at heavy industrial markets today. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final forward-looking concept that we haven't deeply discussed yet, a macroeconomic shadow that looms over this entire industry.
Oh, what's that?
We've spent this time analyzing tariffs and logistics, but we must also consider the existential threat of the 2030s energy transition.
The structural shift away from global fossil fuel reliance.
Exactly. But it's important to think about the specific physical mechanics of that transition as it relates to Tenaris. The global oil extraction industry is fighting a relentless, never-ending battle against geological decline rates.
Wells dry up over time.
Once you tap a well, it immediately starts producing less oil over time. An average oil well declines at nearly 6% every single year. Natural gas wells decline even faster. That means the global energy industry has to constantly, aggressively drill millions of feet of new wells every single year just to maintain the current baseline status quo of production.
So it's a treadmill.
Tenaris' entire business model relies on that relentless, high-speed treadmill of drilling. But if the energy transition truly begins to bite in the 2030s and overall global oil demand finally begins to flatten or decline, that drilling treadmill will drastically slow down.
And if the treadmill slows down, the massive volume demand for Tenaris' premium seamless pipes slows down directly with it.
This massive cyclical harvest machine will eventually have to pivot its manufacturing footprint entirely to supplying tubulars for emerging technologies like carbon capture, utilization and storage, or advanced deep geothermal wells.
Which is starting to look at.
They are actively qualifying those new products now, which is smart. But the sheer volume of steel required for those niche industries might never come close to replacing the traditional oil and gas drilling treadmill. So the provocative question I want to leave you pondering is this: with peak political tariffs artificially boosting margins, peak geopolitical tension trapping supply, and the insiders aggressively selling at the top today, are we actually looking at the final artificially inflated golden years of the traditional OCTG supercycle before the transition takes hold?
That is a fascinating, and for the energy industry, a somewhat haunting thought to end on. You have a brilliant company, practically perfectly adapted to an environment that might be fundamentally permanently changing. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mechanics of Tenaris. Keep questioning the market consensus, keep looking beneath the surface of the headlines for that policy rent, and remember, just because the neighborhood has a secure gate today doesn't mean it will be locked tomorrow.